This is Ebony Bennett, and before we start today's Follow the Money episode, I wanted to let you know that the Australia Institute's End of Financial Year appeal is on right now. And between now and June 30th, every single dollar you donate to the Australia Institute will be matched dollar for dollar until we reach our target of $70,000. That means if you donate $10, the Australia Institute receives $20. If you donate $50, the Australia Institute receives $100. So if you donate right now, you can double the impact of your donation. The Australia Institute and this podcast is supported by listeners like you. We aren't funded by government or political parties. We primarily rely on donations, big and small, from our supporters to fund all of our research and advocacy. Whether it's a monthly donation of $10 or a one-off donation of $100 or $1,000, every single dollar you donate helps fund research that matters. The Australia Institute is one of the country's most influential public policy think tanks. And whether it's this podcast, our popular webinar series, or our top quality research, the Institute is always leading the debate with big new ideas or helping engage the public with issues that are important to them. On this podcast, we really try to bring our research straight to your ears, completely free for anyone to access, and invite you behind the scenes of politics to peel back the curtain and explain the really big important issues in ways that are accessible to everyone. And we love our listeners, so thank you for listening, and please consider making a donation at australiainstitute.org.au. Every donation of $2 or more is tax deductible. Now, on to the episode.
And one for Mum, one for Dad, and one for the country.
And there has never been a more exciting time to be an Australian.
Budgets are about choices, Fran, and you show what you value through the choices you make.
Dead, buried, cremated.
This is coal. Don't be afraid. Don't be scared.
Australia's basically done for. We'll just end up being a third-rate economy.
Republic. How good is Australia?
Just follow the money.
G'day and welcome to Follow the Money, the Australia Institute's podcast demystifying the big economic issues in Australia and putting them in plain English. I'm Ebony Bennett, Deputy Director at the Australia Institute, and today we'll be talking about the flaws in the federal government's proposed Commonwealth Integrity Commission with two eminent Australians, former judge of the Supreme Court of Victoria and senior fellow at the Melbourne Law School, the Honourable David Harper, AMQC, and former judge of the New South Wales Court of Appeal, former justice of the New South Wales Supreme Court and chair of Transparency International Australia, the Honourable Anthony Wheely, QC. They are both part of the National Integrity Committee, a group of former judges auspiced by the Australia Institute who have designed a blueprint for an effective corruption watchdog.
The Morrison government is facing calls to establish a national anti-corruption body in the
way... Polling shows that 80% of Australians want a federal integrity commission, some kind of ICAC or integrity commission.
In a situation where we have no mechanism to hold parliamentarians to account for any breach of trust or any potential corruption.
In December 2018, the Morrison government announced plans to introduce an integrity commission, but its model was criticised as weak and lacking transparency.
It's the integrity commission you have if you don't want to have an integrity commission.
I don't want unelected bureaucrats to have the right to tap my telephone in the same way they've tapped Gladys Berejiklian's private telephone conversations.
Look, I don't particularly want to know. Well, we've got a Senate committee. They get poor over everything we do.
Enough is enough. The establishment of a National Integrity Commission with teeth is long overdue. The government has kept the Australian public waiting for 922 days and has found time to tackle a great number of the government's self-described priorities outside the coronavirus response, but has yet to find time for this one.
Order, Senator Patrick.
More than 59 eminent Australians, including former judges and members of the legal fraternity, penned an open letter to the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, calling for the urgent establishment of a National Integrity Commission, citing the government's election promise to have such a body legislated within 12 months of taking office. So there's no doubt that promise is well overdue, but there are also serious concerns about the government's proposed model. So that's what we're going to talk about today. G'day, Anthony and David. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ebony.
Anthony, I'll start with you. Firstly, can you just tell us why Australia needs a federal anti-corruption commission?
Sure. Well, first of all, we don't have one.
We've never had one. And there's no body at a federal level that effectively is able to scrutinise the behaviour of people in the federal sphere to ensure that, as far as possible, corrupt practices do not occur. On the other hand, we have in every state and territory of Australia anti-corruption bodies, and on the whole, they function very well and are well regarded. So that's the first reason. We don't have one, and we should have one, and there's a large gap. Now, it wouldn't matter so much if there were no scandals from time to time at a federal level, but unfortunately, there are. I don't need to list them here, but we know even only a year or so ago there was a great outcry over what's been described as the sports rort scandal. There was the Leppington Triangle appropriation of property with an enormous payout in circumstances where the land was worth nothing like that. So these things arise from time to time, but they are not investigated effectively at a federal level. And unfortunately, at least to date, the government has really refused to be accountable. So the net result is that the community is very distrustful of our federal government and has lost confidence in it in terms of integrity.
Whenever you get power on the one hand and money on the other, the temptation for money to corrupt the exercise of power is there. And in Australia, the concentration of power is in Canberra. There is plenty of money looking for opportunities to gain advantage from the exercise of that power, and Canberra is the central repository of both those components, and the danger of corrupt conduct therefore is very much something about which Canberra government and all those associated with it should be very concerned. But of all the jurisdictions in Australia, Canberra, the federal area, is the only jurisdiction without a National Integrity Commission or commission of any kind.
Mm. If you're a fan of political scandals and rhymes, then Sports Rorts is right up your alley.
Noon. Some shock revelations from the Sports Rort Inquiry hearing. Tell us.
It stinks more than a bucket of prawn heads that you left out on a hot day.
No rules were broken. Every single one of those 684 projects that were funded was eligible for funding under the guidelines.
What the government was doing was supporting local community infrastructure projects, and I know that all of which were eligible under the program.
All the projects.
Eligibility is one thing, but the audit report makes it clear they could find no legal authority under which the minister could approve the grants. And the new revelations highlight the fact they were not made on merit.
So, David, one of the things that you've been critical of in the government's proposed model is that the definition of corrupt conduct is too narrow. If we start there, why is that an issue?
The narrow definition applies to that segment of the area that is covered by the exposure draft, which includes parliamentarians and the public sector. The definition of corruption in relation to law enforcement is sufficiently wide to satisfy us, and we think anybody who reasonably examines these issues. But the definition of corruption in relation to parliamentarians and the broader segment of the public sector, about two-thirds of public servants, includes the necessity for a criminal offence to be committed before a corrupt act falls within the scope of the exposure draft.
So it's quite a high threshold to meet, essentially.
It's a very high threshold to meet. And not only that, but there must be a reasonable suspicion that a criminal offence has been committed. And before you get to that reasonable suspicion, you can't even start to look at whether or not there is a corruption issue to be examined.
Mm. Anthony, coming back to you now, what are some of the other flaws with the government's proposed model that you've been concerned with?
As David has said, you know, confining it to a criminal offence is really leaving a lot of grey area uncovered. so far as parliamentarians and the public sector are concerned. I'd just like to mention a couple, if I may.
Yeah.
For example, nepotism in appointments, the granting of contracts without appropriate scrutiny, the misuse of confidential information, the misuse of public funds for personal gain or political gain. That's a big topic at the moment, both federally and at state level, but particularly at federal level. And serious conflicts of interest and serious breaches of ministerial codes of conduct. None of these things are necessarily criminal. So I think David's point's a good one. And we think that you need to have a wide definition of corruption to get there. But, of course, as you indicate, there are other things that are difficult as well. I think the two things that really we find inexplicable is that the agency under this model cannot investigate on its own initiative, generally speaking. Secondly, the agency can't, in the case of parliamentarians, their staff, or the vast array of public servants, cannot act on whistleblower complaints. If we just think and pause about that, that's where the complaints are going to come from whistleblowers in the public service, but this agency cannot act on them. They're forbidden to act on a whistleblower complaint. And now, there's no other anti-corruption agency in Australia that operates in that way.
Yeah.
And bear in mind that in law enforcement, of course, the agency can act on whistleblower complaints. So if I complain about the way I'm treated by a police officer, perfectly permissible.
Yep.
Can I do that as somebody who works in an agency where I see serious example of corruption involving a senior public servant, my boss perhaps, or collusion between a public servant and a parliamentarian that looks very, very suspicious? No, I can't.
So effectively, David, it's set up a two-tiered system, one for law enforcement and a separate kind of weaker system that might cover parliamentarians.
Exactly so. And that is a defect in the current exposure draft that is fatal to its success as an appropriate basis for the formation of a National Integrity Commission.
And Anthony, are there any other flaws in the big picture on either side of that two-tiered system that we should be concerned about?
Well, I think not in the law enforcement section, but there's another area we haven't touched on, and that is if I'm a law enforcement officer and I'm suspected of some type of corrupt conduct, a public hearing can be held in which evidence can be taken publicly about what I've been accused of doing. And if I'm found to have acted corruptly, a public report can be then published and no doubt given to Parliament, which is what happens in most of the other states and territories. If, however, I'm a politician, parliamentarian or a member of staff, or if I'm one of the two-thirds of protected public servants, there can be no public hearing involving my corruption and there can be no public report made about it.
It can't look at behaviour that's happened in the past. It can only look at behaviour that's happened after the laws have passed and the body's set up. It can't look at things off its own bat. It can't accept referrals from whistleblowers. So basically the government says, oh, do we feel like investigating ourselves over this allegation? And then if the government wants to investigate itself, it can refer itself to its own integrity commission. I mean, what a joke.
Trade Minister Simon Birmingham, who warns it can't turn into a show trial.
If you're going to have this sort of work, you want to make sure that it is focused squarely on flushing out any wrongdoing, not just destroying reputations for the sake of it.
You want to get the model right. It's got to be robust, but it's got to have public trust too. Public hearings have been effective. You don't need to hold a public hearing on every issue, but you need the commission to have the discretion to hold them in public. Otherwise, you end up having a star chamber in secret.
What's the virtue of a commission such as this being able to hold public hearings? Anthony's talked about, you know, the report won't be available, but is there any other reason why it's important that this body should be able to hold public hearings?
It's a vital power that a commission properly constructed ought to have. Not to use irresponsibly, public hearings should only be undertaken after all the proper precautions have preceded the public hearing. But public hearings are essential, partly because they may exculpate clearly and publicly those who have had accusations made against them that are shown to be false. Secondly, because they educate the public in matters concerning the commission of corrupt activities. And thirdly, because without the capacity to conduct public hearings, you won't be able to tap into those portions of the public, those members of the public who may know something about the issue under investigation, but who haven't come forward because there's been no entity, no capacity to bring what they know to the attention of the authorities. With a public hearing, the word will get out. And, for example, in Victoria, a public hearing into corruption in the education department produced a wealth of very important evidence which would not have been brought to IBAC without the public hearing.
Yeah, IBAC being Victoria's Anti-Corruption Commission.
It struck me because I've actually sat as an ICAC commissioner in New South Wales, only briefly, but it was an interesting experience. And what came to me in terms of a public hearing was it enables the public to scrutinise the way in which I am behaving myself as an ICAC commissioner. So I think there's nothing worse than hearings being conducted behind closed doors where there may be an allegation that the commissioner is guilty of bias, inappropriate behaviour and the like. It's a bit like judges in courts, you know. There's something that's very edifying about this being done publicly, as long as it's done appropriately at the same time.
So justice not only to be done, but seen to be done.
Seen
but
to be
actually,
done properly.
Yeah, the public hearings provide some quite practical functions for that.
I mean, if it's not done properly in public, then the public know that this is not working.
What would your message be, David, about fixing some of these flaws? What needs to happen?
Well, most importantly, you need to have a commission which is appropriately financed, appropriately manned with personnel who are sufficiently sensible to be able to run this very important commission in ways which ensure that it acts fairly but vigorously in protection of the public against corrupt activities.
Anthony, if I can come to you now, the National Integrity Committee of Judges has put a lot of effort into drawing up a blueprint for what an effective watchdog would look like. Can you just briefly summarise those key issues for us again?
Sure. I mean, I think to put it in one sentence, it would look a little bit like Helen Haynes' bill. But what it contains is a proper and wide definition of corrupt conduct. It's limited, however, to serious and systemic corruption. Secondly, it should have a broad range of investigative powers that are very similar to those of a royal commission. It should have the power to hold public hearings, but only where it's appropriate to do so and in the public interest. It should have a commissioner and two deputy commissioners who have the proper qualifications. And it should be empowered to make findings of facts or perhaps in some cases to make a decision as to whether there has been any corrupt conduct or perhaps, more importantly, there's been no corrupt conduct. And there needs to be proper oversight in the form of, parliamentary oversight and also appellate administrative intervention if errors of law are made. And I'd add just to that one thing, and that is probably the main reason that's been put forward to us why our model is not popular with the government stems around the holding of public hearings and making public reports. And it's been said that the danger is that reputations will be unfairly damaged.
The idea that someone's political enemies might use it as a political process to wound someone.
That's one way it might occur. Now, I think David and I would both agree that that's a fair concern. We would be concerned about that as well. But I think the answer is you can provide in the legislation or surrounding the legislation sufficient protections to make sure that that does not happen.
One of those being that it will only investigate serious and systemic corruption, yes, not just any old complaint.
That's right. And that there will be guidelines published which will ensure procedural fairness, impartiality, that any exculpatory material investigator agency has will be supplied to the person being investigated, and that they will have an opportunity before any public finding of answering the submissions that are being made against them.
Mm. There's been a disregard and a carelessness to accountability and good governance in the last few years.
Mr. Gaitans, the Prime Minister refuses to answer a question in the Parliament. Let's be clear, it is part of a cover-up.
The Leppington Triangle mystery. How could this dairy farm in Sydney's west be worth so much?
There has been an audit into this system. It has been scathing of the process that's been in place, saying that there have been incredible failings.
Did you mislead the House of Representatives when you said that no authorisation was provided by you? And why did your office do that if you had no role in authorising them?
It's good to see that the Canberra Press Gallery is back to politics as usual with Parliament coming back. Yeah, thank you. I've answered your question. I said no.
So I guess I want to come back to the issue that, in part, there's obviously gaps in the integrity system that we've got federally, but also over many years we've seen that the public really has lost a lot of faith in our democratic institutions, and partly that's the perception, or otherwise, I guess, that there is corruption in politics. We know it exists at the state level. This is an attempt to address it at the federal level. But how much do you think this will go, David, towards helping to restore that kind of public trust in our institutions?
I think it will be integral in the restoration of public confidence in democratic institutions. And that is absolutely vital given the very low estimation of public office in Australia at present. Mm. Democracy cannot survive appropriately if the public does not trust its politicians to act honestly. And this commission should, in its existence, give the confidence that the public needs that politicians will no longer be able to act without fear of consequence if they are guilty of corrupt conduct.
Mm. And Anthony, coming back to you, you know, as someone who's formerly sat in the New South Wales ICAC and heard these types of things, can you just reflect overall on the impact that you see them have in the community and why they are so important?
Yes, I think that there's a threefold benefit of having a body like this. The first is that it actually has the capacity to investigate and uncover corrupt practices, and they're very difficult to locate. That's why you need these wide powers. Secondly, I think that they provide a very good educational function, and all of the anti-corruption bodies I know publish a second report in addition to what I'd call their public report, in which recommendations are made to government departments to improve probity and proper conduct and at administrative level, and that's a very useful educative tool. And the third way in which they're useful is the government can approach the independent body and it can submit contracts to it for consideration, and it can more or less ask for a sanction or imprimatur about a proposed a dealing that it's going to have, say, with another country, mm-hmm, or with one of the states. And my experience is that they are very valuable aspects to the operation of such a body, and they're rather overlooked by people who are fearful that it's not going to be a good thing for them. And yeah, I do think politicians are afraid of being held accountable, and they fail to see that this is really helpful to them, not a hindrance to the proper administration and the carrying out of their duties.
Yeah. And finally, David, we're here recording in Parliament House. I'm not sure how good these microphones are, but I can hear the ticking of the Parliament House clocks in the background. We've seen in a very short time this issue really turn around and become one of national significance, the need for a federal anti-corruption commission. It wasn't that long ago that neither major party supported it. Now we've got both major parties, the crossbench, really the whole of Parliament behind this, and we're really only arguing about what the model looks like. Everyone agrees that we need one. Have you been heartened, I guess, by the way the community and the public have really backed this issue and the way that Parliament has responded?
It's been very heartening indeed. We did start from a very low base, as you said, but there now seems to be an almost irresistible tide towards the creation of a National Integrity Commission which will be effective. That's not where we are at present, but I do think that we're better positioned now than we've ever been to move forward in a constructive and appropriately serious way with the creation of the body we need.
Excellent. Well, that's all we have time for today. Thank you so much. This episode was recorded on Tuesday, the 22nd of June, and things may have changed since recording. You can visit australiainstitute.org.au for all our latest research, including the blueprint and design models for an effective anti-corruption commission designed by the National Integrity Committee. We're on Twitter at the Oz Institute with an AUS, and my Twitter handle is ebony_Bennett with a double N double T. This episode was produced by Jennifer Macy, and our theme music is by Jonathan McFeet from Pulse and Thrum. Stay safe out there, and thanks for listening.